Notice here, there are two different kinds of journeys. There's a journey which is natural, which is like clockwise. It's the way that the sun rises. But consciousness is a journey in the other direction. It's towards like sunset, if you want to say. Now, even in the archaic formulations of the wisdom tradition and the earliest written records that we have of the whole process are from ancient Egypt, the Book of the Two Ways. There are always the two ways. And to be complete, one has to be able to go and come back. One has to be able to go the both ways. And if you're just dedicated like all get out to the one way, only realization. The Indian word that was developed in the 6th and 7th century that is applicable to that kind of development, that focus is bindu, vanishing point. Then one is a real celestial hero. The spirit of life is sick to death of the selfish celestial heroes that take everything with them and leave and help no one. She won't have it anymore. These super yogis are bad children, and they've left the rest of life in very bad situations. And they may have to be recalled back through that bindu to come and do some work. Lazy sons of bitches. Lolling in their nirvana. Hey, it's time to come back and do some work. So the quality here in Virgil is quite distinct from Odysseus. So too, in Chaucer, in the Canterbury Tales, it's a different quality from Moby Dick. Moby Dick is a journey towards the realization that sometimes one discovers that one is an orphan. That's what happened. You don't have any home. You found that you're just adrift on the ocean and saved just by virtue of someone else's coffin from drowning. And you're just happy that some passerby looking for lost children picks you up because you're just another orphan. That's the way it is sometimes. But the complement to that is in Chaucer. The complement to that is the discovery that the voyaging together of all the orphans is itself another kind of pilgrimage, another kind of a quest, the kind of quest that doesn't depend on getting to the goal, but it depends on the quality of your going together. What you do and what you say and the going is what's important, and not getting there. Canterbury is a wonderful place, and Chaucer doesn't care if his people get there this year, next year, or 500 years, or ever. It's the journey together that's important. And what is discovered in the journey together are exactly the complete spectrum of all the character types of human nature. Notice that human nature doesn't come in just indefinite numbers of types. It may have indefinite numbers of individuals, but the character types are very accurate. There's about 28 different character types. And Chaucer puts them all there in the Canterbury Tales. There's one of each. You talk about character typology. You want to talk about character typology? Jung's great book on personality types is completely unknowing of Chaucer and that whole tradition. He had a tremendous European education. He didn't know beans about Africa or China or the American Indians or even England. There are all kinds of possibilities. Chaucer's Canterbury Tales is the journey of the beauty of making the journey, and the goal is not what's important. And it's the complement, it's the underside of what Moby Dick presents. There is a realization that you're all alone and adrift, but the recognition pattern that comes out of that, that can be developed out of that, is then that the journey of life is what is important for you. And who you're with, that's the cast of characters. You're not putting your value in the angels in paradise so much as putting the value in the companions along the way. They're what's important. And this is an archetypal pattern of the journey, which is very frequent in our time. What does Chaucer write about? He says, I write about a fair field full of folk. I write about a field of consciousness that the reality is in the character of the people who are there. They constitute the field of what I'm interested in. So now in Chaucer, one of the proper ways to start with the Canterbury Tales is with the prologue. And if you were in this program and you were starting at the beginning of the magic at the end of the first of the year, you would have started reading the prologue of the Canterbury Tales. And by this time, by history, you probably would have gotten to the great tale, The Wife of Bath's Tale. One of the most gutsy women of all time, the wife of Bath, who is busy smiling broadly and moving her cleavage around to see who's looking and just what can she find out from them. And in the prologue, because Chaucer is so humane, do you know where he lived? Do you know where his house was? His house was over one of the main gates of London, so he saw people coming and going. His view where he sat to sup was right over one of the main gates of London. He would sit there in his beautifully brushed red burgundy velvet suit and marvel at the passers-by, how mankind came in such incredible varieties, and how always the same type, the same circle, the zodiac of personalities obtained again and again. Oh, here's another one of those. Isn't that interesting? Look how it worked out this time. The prologue to The Wife of Bath's Tale. It reads like this. This is the Penguin Classics edition, put into modern English out of the Middle English of Chaucer by Neville Coghill. If there were no authority on earth except experience, mine for what it's worth, and that's enough for me. All goes to show that marriage is a misery and a woe. For let me say, if I may make so bold, my lords, since I was but 12 years old, thanks be to God eternal evermore, 5 husbands have I had at the church door. Yes, it's a fact that I've had so many, all worthy in their way and as good as any. Someone said recently for my persuasion that as Christ went only on one occasion to grace a wedding in Cana of Galilee, he taught me by example there to see that it is wrong to marry more than once. Consider too how sharply for the nonce he spoke, rebuking the Samaritan beside the well, Christ Jesus, God and man. Thou hast had 5 men husband unto thee, and he that even now thou hast, said he, is not thy husband. Such the words that fell. But what he meant thereby I cannot tell. Why was her 5th? Explain it if you can. No lawful spouse to the Samaritan. How many might have had her then to wife? I've never heard an answer all my life. To give the number final definition, People may guess or frame a supposition, but I can say for certain it's no lie. God bade us all to wax and multiply. That, kindly text, I well can understand. Is not my husband under God's command to leave his father and mother and take me? And it turns out that the Ba'athah wife then says that she indeed has a secret that she can alone can give. She knows what woman really wants. What in all the world do women really want? And of course the wife of Ba'athah's tale is incredible and uncanny in the way in which she tells her story and shows, not to keep you in too much suspense. What a woman really wants is to control the opinions of her man. So Chaucer is interesting. In all the range of human types, he includes even a wife of Bath. I guess you know that Bath, England, was so named because the Romans had huge baths there, because the Druids before them had huge baths there. And it was like the image where you go there specifically to take your clothes off and be together. So the wife of Bath is well named. Chaucer was quite humane in his outlook on life. Incidentally, his job was he was the vintner for the king. His wife was the sister of the king's wife, so he, in an odd way, was almost related to the king. And he traveled to France and Italy often to buy wine for the king. You didn't just buy cases, but you bought whole seasons for the king of England. You'd buy the entire season's output of this district and so forth. And Chaucer was one of the few great international figures of his day. He knew everybody on all scales of life, which is why the Canterbury Tales is so full of humanity. English literature before Chaucer is unhumane compared to Chaucer. Chaucer is the first great reformation in English literature. He's the first one to bring the human personality into the focus. The greatest English epic that starts the English language, starts English literature, I think written by the Venerable Bede about 700 AD, is Beowulf, the English national epic. But it's mythic. Beowulf's the bear's son. But with Chaucer, what triumphs is not the mythic type, but the human insight into all the ways in which we are human, and loving humanity because, well, we have to struggle with this, don't we? And we do struggle with it, and we deserve to talk to each other about this struggle and to be commended for this courage in life. And Chaucer brings that element into English literature. It's never amplified and developed until Shakespeare. What Chaucer does is the high point until Shakespeare's day. So you can see what a tremendous figure he is. So Virgil and Chaucer are conscious. They deal in a historical, humane sense, whereas Melville and Homer are Protean in a natural, mythic sense. Moby Dick and the Odyssey are natural-based, mythic journeys. But the Aeneid and the Canterbury Tales are conscious journeys that people make for specific purposes, for historical recognitions. So you can see that the educational pattern has its large-scale operative features as well. I have to bring this in at this particular point to keep reminding. I don't think any of you are taking the full pattern, but you need to know that it's there. And I need to remember to keep it all there. books of hours, how many were able to bring a book of hours? 1, 2, 3, 4. Just 4 of you. How many are working on a book of hours? 1. Are you not? Yeah. Are you working on a book of hours? I'm going to get you to work on a book of hours. Walter, are you? You're going to begin this week? Yes, that's the whole purpose of a book of hours. Is that one day. A day. Toshi, are you working on a book of hours? Oh, good. All right. Try and bring them all next week, because that book of hours is only a preliminary. It's only the Franklin element. The Thucydidean element is much more important right now. And that Thucydidean element is to find what pattern has been operating for you the last year and a half. Now, if you've been in the course itself will be an accurate guide. You'll be able to much easier reconstruct the pattern of what's been happening. Not internally, specifically, but in your life. And how is all this coming together? What pattern is this? For you must understand that there is a pattern. Whether you see it or not, know it or not, there is a pattern. Now, if the pattern is unconscious, or to be more generous, if it's subconscious, the pattern will have a stronger voice in your life than you will. The story will tell you. If you energize yourself to this level of sensitivity, if you do not have a consciousness comprehensive enough to have that pattern will begin to tell you. Now, this is the existential quandary. Don Miguel de Unamuno, the great Spanish philosopher who died in the Spanish Civil War, carried on a genre which was developed by Cervantes, who was a contemporary of Shakespeare. Cervantes not only wrote Don Quixote, but he also wrote a series of what he called exemplary novels. And each of the novels, the exemplary novels, was to show a particular pattern in human existence. Here's this one, here's this one, reminiscence of Chaucer. Don Miguel de Unamuno in the 1930s continued that Cervantian tradition, and he wrote a series of exemplary novels. But at the end of his book, Exemplary Novels, Unamuno has a dialogue that's not in any one of the stories. And the dialogue is actually a record of the characters from the stories coming in to interview the author and demanding that he write more stories. Since he has created them, they are as real as people would be, and they have the right to further existence, and the author owes them further existence by writing more stories for them to live in. It's a wonderful little existential parable. Unamuno was very capable of that. He was kind of a philosophic Antonio Gaudí, if you can imagine. The white beard, the piercing eyes, carrying a whole universe of insight around with every step. Writing your history, your personal history of the last year and a half, is the essential task. reading these things that I put out there for you and hearing these lectures, participating in this continuity, all of that is important. But the jewel in the lotus is your ability to see into your life now in two different ways at the same time. One, that there is a way of patterning your internal sense, and two, to see that the external of your life as a developing pattern is such and so and is actually related directly to that internal pattern. The book of ours is an internal matrix. The history of the last year and a half is an external quality, pattern that goes with it. So the important thing is really to write that external history. But you need that internal book of days pattern in order to have some kind of a template, some kind of a frame of reference through which you can hone your vision of the pattern. Otherwise, it would take a very long time. It would take a lot of dialogue individually between me and you individually to bring this out. How long would it take? It takes as long as a psychotherapy. How long does that take? Like Woody Allen says, he's been going for 20 years. He just realized he never knew the name of the psychiatrist yet. It can be an indefinite pattern. This technique is like a diamond vehicle, straight line. It's a radius that doesn't go around in the circle, but goes right to the heart of the matter, right to the center. If this historical process is followed accurately, in 3 months you can do what in 20 years it would take someone in a standard therapy to get around to discovering that's what they really need to do. What do you really do in a therapy? A therapy is effective when you decide to stop going. That's when a therapy is effective. When you decide, I don't need that anymore. Now that's a big mystery. If you've never done that, that doesn't sound right. And if you have, you couldn't miss it. You couldn't miss it. We need to look at a couple of books of days in order for you to get an idea of how this works. So did anybody bring their book of days, or book of hours, rather? Good. We're in business. All you need is one. Would you share it with us as an example? Is this why you bent over this morning? You were bringing in your book of hours? Okay. Tell everyone your name. Some don't know you.
I'm Stephen Lynn.
Okay.
And
you've just been in here a month, right?
Yes.
Okay, good.
And I missed the second Saturday where you explained to use quotes.
Yes.
So I didn't have very many quotes in there.
Okay, but you did the best that you could, and you brought something, which you can see that you're now the head of the pack. This is not a class, this is a pack. That's why all the slavering. Go on.
And I started at midnight, and then I listened to your tape, and you said if you were missed before, you would start at midnight.
And you relaxed more.
Yes. Well, what do you want me to do? Want me to read?
Yes, I do. I want you to read it.
Starting
at the beginning, yeah.
Starting at midnight?
Yeah. Okay, you started at midnight. Was it actually midnight when you were starting it?
Yes.
Okay, good. Wonderful.
And I wrote, an ending and a beginning, true to drift off fine to dreams, to thought to chatter to chatter. Vague rumbles deep in the night, highlight the time of quiet. Still air. Still air. Still, S-T-I-L-L, air.
Still air.
Ultimate night. I think I wrote that as a separate day. And then I did put a quote down for this afterwards. The Tao that is Tao is not the self-same Tao. A translation of the first line of the Tao Te Ching.
Yeah, Dichi Suzuki's rendition of it.
I start at the point of unknowing.
Yes. Yes, if you start at a point of knowing, you prejudice whatever geometry is going to come out of there. If you start with unknowing, everything can happen. Anything.
In the next 2 hours, I was asleep.
What do you have then? You have 1 o'clock blank?
Yes, 2 o'clock blank.
Okay, those are yet to be filled in, and you have to figure some way to fill those in. You can ask the gal next to you. She knows about filling in because she's got 24 hours to fill. I'm teasing. I'm just teasing you. I'm trying to get juices flowing. It's my way of loving you. Please. It was flowing, though, naturally, and you weren't particularly thinking about it using that kind of language, but that's what was coming out.
3 a.m. Under a pall of quiet, strength surges into wakefulness / images. The stillness, a spotlight on any action, like cacti in a desert evolved from flora abundant, dreamed or awake, soothing action reminds me of the heat.
That's a pall of quiet, not a paw of quiet.
Yes, a pall.
Oh, okay.
And 4 a.m. is still blank. 5 a.m. Impenetrable darkness, dragging back to heavy sleep. Sun coming soon? Question mark. Stillness prolonged, pregnant with pause.
Pregnant with pause.
This reminds me of the yin and yang. When you get to the extreme, the opposite starts to emerge out of it. And at 5 in the morning, starting to change.
One time on a particular yajna in India, Vinoba Bhave was a successor to Gandhi. He was trying to explain yoga to the villagers, and they were not following it because they thought, well, we're only villagers and yoga is for the masters, right? So finally he said, look, when you finish breathing in, there's a pause before you breathe out. And when you breathe out, there's a pause before you breathe in. If you just focus your attention on these pauses so that that becomes a continuous consciousness, that's yoga. And there's a beautiful way of expressing it. Pregnant pauses.
6 and 7 a.m. are still blank. I've got more going to do. 8 a.m. Awake or awakening. The slanting shadows outside trying to stay warm. Physically and intellectually urgent movement. A continuing desire for slumber. 9 a.m. Sun rising claims shadows as I move inevitably to greater activity. Cool air, voice layer over cool meadows outside. Lawns. And another day I go lazy, 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 tired, tired, tired. I wrote that this morning.
You wrote that this morning at 11 o'clock?
Oh, no, I wrote it another day. I'm not a morning person.
No, if the sunlight is painful at 8 o'clock, it's...
10 a.m., active energy, insight is here. No turning back, the day is definitely upon us. 11 a.m., time to eat, to break from work. Free time, fun looms ahead. Not structure time, tired, unfocused, uptight, not sharp mind, cutting to the quick, relaxed after eating.
Now, let's pause there for a second. Notice now, if you're doing a book of hours, is your noon characteristically that? Are you characteristically tired at every noon? Notice now that with the book of hours, what's refining about it is that you want to be able to smoothly go through a 24-hour ambit with that book of hours as your guide, as your template. Now, are you content with setting up the fact that at every noon you're going to be tired?
No.
You see what a book of hours does? It refines the sense that what's important here is not just the hour, but the flow from hour to hour, the making of a day. Notice that the sense of hours is a temporal phase, dot formation kind of an activity. But the making of a book of hours is a durational flow, wholeness, making quality. So that it's useful. It's like, you know, somebody that first is learning the Tai Chi movements, they're trying to picture in their mind, is this the way, is that the way? And there's no exercise. There's just a staccato presentation of this attempt at this phase and that attempt at that posture and so on. But after a while, none of that is really relevant. All of that is extraneous to the flow that actually occurs. That's what a book of hours is for, is to make time durational and thus creative rather than just a sequential and thus a pitfall. It's to transform the pitfall into creativity. It's a wonderful technique. It's a medieval technique. High Middle Ages, nevertheless, is very, very useful. Let's try the next 12 hours then.
1 p.m. Resting, face to more resumed activity. Extreme yawn resolves. The sky is bright with the sun. The eyes need shade to prevent from squinting. 2 p.m. Afternoon. Posting. Maybe it's time for a nap, or should continue working hard. The air is still stifled, at its extreme heat, about to begin the transformation back down. White light, no shadows, whiteness. Time for a nap. Vaguely dissatisfied, bored. There's a quote, "Two different minds, the same world, is the hell and the heaven." Ralph Waldo Emerson. The heat of the day beckons me outside. 3 p.m., time for a nap. A lazy day continues. Still being lazy, sleepy, avoiding the boss's wife, avoiding.
Better keep this under lock and key.
I've been inspired by my cat tonight. 4 p.m., vague desires for food, rest, relax, aimings of the day, foreplay to pleasures and workaday freedom. Posting now, conserving effort. The best way out is always through, is a quote from Robert Frost. Okay, 5 p.m., daylight turning red, ending work almost done. Thoughts of private pursuits unleashed. And I put a quote down. The sun machine is going down, from David Bowie of all people. Mm-hmm. Can we have anything?
I have a couple.
6 p.m. To air is human. Who said that? Was that Shakespeare? I don't know.
I think he did somewhere.
Not verbally, I feel the shadows wander from the red sun. Equilibrium of light and day, busy time for people to move from place to do or retire. or to receive others from their rush. And another day I wrote, eating, feeling satiated, well-being, balance, light.
Now notice here how if you put something down that occurs to you, that's all right. But if you do it for several days and then go back over it and reread it, you begin to notice what's characteristic about 6 p.m. for you. So what's characteristic will emerge. So that your Book of Hours, while it may be associative when it first begins, tends more and more to be archetypal. More and more as it matures, in its fullness, what becomes important is the durational cycle of the day, and every hour yields its part to this, so that there is a motion that comes, a duration. Henri Bergson said, the duration is the creative elan. It isn't time. It is not time. Time is the record, the imprint left by this passing. But it is this elan which is real and not the time. The clock is not real. But what occurs during the clock's motion, that can be real. That, in other words, can be recognized by consciousness. So these two observations at 6 p.m. are leading towards something more primordial. And it may take 4 or 5 more 6 p.m. designations and a couple of quotes or something, but eventually you can tease it out. Now notice that once you do this in any part of the cycle, you have an insight into the rest of it. Like a principle, any good yoga. If you perfect the yoga of the little finger eventually and do that, the whole body will fall into order because of that. Why? Because the body as any reality is an integrated system. Any part of it that's organized, the whole becomes organized eventually. It's absolutely true. The same thing here with temporality. Temporality, when it's subconscious, tends to be extremely fictive and obscuring, but when it becomes conscious, it tends to become exacting. The whole difference between magic and science is that time is conscious in science. It's exacting. Wallace Stevens in his theory of poetry, he says that the poet is one who measures solitude to the hour. There's an exacting. Or Marcel Proust says that in remembrance, man redeems time from its fictive morass and brings it into the life of the person. And one exists in the real. It's a very, very powerful insight. And once it's done anywhere in an integrated expression, that conveys its veracity to every other part of the expression. For instance, it's only in the 7th part of A la Recherche du Temps Perdu that Proust comes to the consciousness, the recapturing of the past. But in retrospect, it conveys its veracity all the way to the beginning of Swan's Way. If you read the very first page of Proust's magnificent epic, you get this eerie sense that the reading of this is a reality-making exercise. This is what's happening. This is what the man's doing. And when we are reading it, We are sitting where he is sitting, inside of his personality, making this happen. If you conscientiously, in a dedicated yoga position, read 10 pages of Proust, you can come away and you could write like Proust. Even in the Scott Moncrief English translation. Why? Because you have picked up the knack of saving the real from time. From the fictive temporalizing to the personal durational creativity is a very, very powerful technique. I remember when I was a young undergrad at the University of Wisconsin, about 17 years old, and I used to eat lunch every day with a professor of German, Germain Bray, who wrote a beautiful book on Proust, and was a friend of Camus and everything. And she used to constantly say to me, you're not really reading it right. I'd say, I read 50 pages. No, you're not really reading it right. And then after a while, after several months, I could see that's right, I was not reading it right. I was reading it as if Proust were writing from my standpoint. I had to learn to read it from Proust's standpoint, how he wrote it. When you read it with the flavor of the writer, then that's different. Then what can be conveyed to you is conveyed to you. And if it's a very great writer like Proust, or like Virgil, or like Chaucer, whammo, bullseye, what is the target? Your inner self recognizes that it's been touched. Why is a haiku by Basho so eternal? Doesn't matter if it's translated even into English, it still hits you. It's incredible. There's a new book that's out of a British woman who went on Basho's journey, the 800 miles of Basho's journey. Chatterton's books has it. And she records her impressions of what she sees, along with Basho's Narrow Road to the Deep North, Ryoko no Hosomichi. And she again and again comes to the surprise that Basho is still alive, still real. What he sees can still be seen in exactly that way, there. The mystery of the reality of the human spirit is remarkable. Once made, it's there forever. Now, primordial man, so-called primitive man, could only express it by saying, some places have mana, some things have mana, some things happen, this has got mana now. Does this rock have mana? No, but this one does. It's the subconscious realization that something eternal and real has occurred and can never unoccur. As Plotinus says, nothing of the real soul is ever annulled. And that's true. We just don't realize the implications of that. The way I was taught, the phrase that was used just rang in my ear when I heard it, never not is, after that. So that the working with temporality here, like we're back to 6 p.m. in Steve's Book of Hours, they may be fleeting glimpses to begin with, but the glimpses all have a characteristic, which is that they're going to be more and more magnetized to a real focus, which needs to be teased out. And once you do that for any hour of the day, all the rest of them are going to fall in order very, very easily, much more easily than you suppose. In fact, you will get what all of us get, a kind of a rush, kind of a psychological high, when you realize that what you're doing is really happening. It really is efficacious, and we all become childlike in our eagerness to explore that. Well, what else can I do? Look at this. You know, and it's that kind of a quality where the elan becomes yours. It's not just some plot, some tight figured plot that's manipulating you. That energy is yours. Yours to express. You may tell the story in any way, in any version in which you want to. You could tell the Orpheus myth in such a way that you bring Eurydice back. You have the freedom to do that. We've got 6 more hours to go and then we're done.
7 p.m. is blank.
7 p.m. is blank. Very interesting. But notice now, it's like both sides are workable. Is 7 p.m. blank every day? Notice that this would be a real insight, that on every day for a week, 7 p.m. is blank. That's significant. It's like a word association test. It's not only what you do associate, but the fact that occasionally you don't have...
Nine
p.m.
No, 10. That was 9.
Was that 9?
Yeah.
Okay.
10 p.m. Energy and verb still active usually, though waning at times. They still have descended, as though crept up from the holes dug in the earth by the small creatures which dwell there. Indulgence. Time to spend on my own pursuits. At last, nothing impending. 11 p.m. Darkness total, encasing the sky, sleep beckoning, fun clinging, consciousness fading, fighting, back to reality, dreams beckoning.
Very good. Let me just say this personally to you. You would get a lot out of reading the section of Thoreau's journal for the summer of 1840. Especially June. I've got it here in several editions. If you just read through some of Thoreau's journal for June of 1840, you would find a kindred soul. He would speak right to you. More next week. Thank you.